KSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hello, this is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, August 21st, 2026. I'm your host, Nick Seabrook. Rabble.ca shares the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. This week, we're digging into the archives for a look back at January 2010. In this episode, a massive wave of protests hits Parliament Hill as Canadians rally against Prime Minister Stephen Harper's prorogation of Parliament. We break down activist strategy. Then Olivia Ward joins the conversation to discuss the critical battle for women's rights in Afghanistan. We'll also cross over with the Rabble Podcast Network show, Street Cred, for a look at the facelift transformation of Regent Park. Going back to January 2010, here is that episode.
Okay, so you've joined the Facebook group against proroguing Parliament. But are you going to heft your body away from your computer desk on January 23rd to attend a protest about it? Nathalie Desrosiers is the executive director of the Canadian Civil Liberties Association, and she thinks you should. I reached her to talk about why. Hello, Ms. Desrosiers.
Hello.
How are you?
Pretty good.
Good. So the Facebook group against proroguing Parliament has now hit almost 170,000 members, and the protests are being planned across the country for January 23rd. But I'm wondering, from your perspective, what do street demonstrations accomplish?
Well, they accomplish a great deal. They show that people are really care for the issue. It's not being only what you stand for, but what you stand up for when you have a gesture that accompanies your words. And that's the reason why demonstrations throughout the world continue to exist, because they are listened to.
How do you think that the government views street protests versus online protests?
Well, I think that a public protest that is generalized throughout Canada identifies for the government that this has not gone unnoticed. It's something to be sitting comfortably by one computer and say, well, I kind of disagree with this. It's something else to stand in the cold and say, this is unacceptable. And that's the difference. And I think governments are in tune to how, and want to be in tune to how their constituents feel about issue. And that's just raised the issue a different notch. It just signifies that it's a little bit more serious than they had thought of.
And do you think, I mean, there's been a lot of media reporting about the Facebook group, with the media paying such close attention to what happens online. Do you think that the government's perception of online activism and demonstrations is changing? Do you think the value that they ascribe to those two activities is different?
Well, I'm sure that they pay attention to the Facebook protests and so on. I think it's a different order of magnitude when they see real bodies. So I think it brings a more concrete face to the protest. And we know it's hard to know what will influence a government to act or not to act. But certainly I think we know that the more concrete and the more determined a constituency is about making sure that the issue is heard, will probably improve its likelihood that it will be listened to and acted upon.
What's the message, you think, when people actually get up and stand up?
Well, I think the message is that this is unacceptable, that and that's the reason why you get off the comfort of your home to go outside, is because you really want the government to know that you're willing to spend some time on this issue and that you want them to take to notice you. So that's the key point. It's an exercise in freedom of expression. It's protected by the charter. It's what people do when they think that the government needs to hear in a different register. And it has been successful in the past. We've organized rallies over the years to stop legislation that, and they were withdrawn. So it can have an impact. Here, well, will government decide to change its mind about the prorogation? It's hard to know how committed they are. We'll see, but I think what it does is that it signifies to government that they shouldn't do that again. And my sense is that it would signify a change of tone, I think, and better explanations from the government as to why they decided to prorogue Parliament. Mm-hmm.
And when you hear about this protest, what are you expecting? Are you expecting a lot of people?
Well, we're going to be there. Well, I think it's important, I think, that citizens react when their democracy is being thwarted. And that's what it's all about. It's not about, it's about saying, this is important. You know, the tool that we have for accountability of a government should not be taken for granted. They should not be played with. I mean, many people have given their lives to have democratic government, accountable, responsible government, and we shouldn't just play around with these notions because we don't know what will be in the future. In other countries, they have moved from more democracy to less democracy, from democracy to dictatorial government, and we certainly don't want this to happen. So we want to ensure that the tools of government, the tools of accountability are respected, are used, and are not played around. I think that's the message of this demonstration.
Well, thanks for talking with me today. Maybe we'll see you out in the street.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. That was Nathalie Desrosiers, the executive director of the Canadian Civil Liberties Association. She was speaking about protests and just what they accomplish. If you agree with her sentiment, but you don't agree with what Stephen Harper is doing when it comes to the prorogation of Parliament, you can show your support by heading to your local demonstration on the subject on January 23rd. Listings will be at whatsup@rabble.ca.
Regent Park is Canada's oldest and largest housing project, but things are changing. Revitalization of the area means many phases of construction and low-income residents were forced to move as redevelopment takes place. The City of Toronto says the project will replace outdated social housing projects with energy-efficient homes and market condominiums. The Rabble Podcast Network's Street Cred podcast took a trip to Regent Park to find out more.
In the last few years, this area east of downtown has undergone a massive redevelopment. The city's Regent Park revitalization plan will take many years and phases to complete. 24-year-old U of T student Aisha grew up in Regent and continues to live there, not knowing when her family will have to relocate.
Well, they were having community meetings. I found them to be really confusing. You always think you're going to find out like one thing and they tell you something else. Another thing that's been really a bit irritating as they've been continuously changing their ideas and their plans. My area was supposed to be part of like phase 7, then they bumped it up to phase 2, and then they bumped it down to phase 4, and I'm not particularly sure what phase we're in right now. And they keep changing it. Every time you talk to them, they're always like, oh, this section's going to come down in like March, and then it's, you know, as you approach January, then you find out it's going to be in August, and then, you know, oh, it's next year, and then it's next spring, next fall. So they've never been, I mean, I understand in construction it's hard to pinpoint a particular time, but it's frustrating for the people that are living there not to know where they're going to be in a couple of months or where they're going to be a year from now.
Liz Root is Toronto Community Housing's project director for the revitalization. Root says residents are consulted throughout the process.
The community of Regent Park has been involved every step of the way. Through the planning process, well over 2,000 residents in this community participated and they gave us their ideas about what the vision was. And what they told us was it's about replace the housing, which was well over 50 years old and it not meeting the needs of the community that lived here. But they also said as part of that, you know, reintegrate us into the surrounding neighborhood. All the streets that had been cut off in the 1940s and 50s with the original redevelopment essentially had isolated this community for many, many years.
Aisha's family doesn't look forward to leaving the place they've called home for so long, at an uncertain time in the future.
It's hard to discuss because you might have a plan, but it's only going to work within the next few months and you don't know when it's going to be breaking down. So it's kind of hard to have a solid plan. I think my parents probably would like to come back to the buildings once they're rebuilt. For us, it's just been 18 years. Some of these people have been here for like 20, 25 years. And that's like a long time to be in one place and you build a lot of social relationships. and really strong bonds and stuff. And I know when you move, you can still keep in touch with, you know, a telephone and whatnot, but I think it's not the same as, you know, you cross the street and your friend's house is right there.
The committee set up to represent residents is the Regent Park Neighborhood Initiative. Led by longtime resident Neil Clark, this group supports the effort to build new housing.
The reason why it's actually being torn down is because through successive governments and successive property management people in Metro Housing and Ontario Housing, which merged into Toronto Community Housing, the places were not properly maintained. And I believe they figured out it was cheaper to tear it down and start over than it was to actually try and fix it.
But Aisha is skeptical about the city's motives of building market condominiums in an area where rent geared to income is needed.
The buildings that are currently there, they are, like, you know, disintegrating at a really fast rate. Also because Toronto Community Housing has kind of stopped upkeeping them as much, also because they know that they're breaking down soon. So that's led to their degeneration a lot faster. They did definitely need to be replaced. How they're being replaced, I'm not sure I entirely agree with, just because I know that they're cutting down the number of social housing units as well. So they're decreasing the number of social housing units, which I don't agree with, because I think social housing is something that our community really needs. And decreasing the units is, I don't think, is a good, has positive, you know, outcomes for anybody.
Former Toronto Mayor John Sewell once represented Regent Park at council. Sewell is still very active there and helped form a plan that focused on more social units.
When I was working with residents there, they made it very clear, we don't want any redevelopment unless there's more affordable housing than there is now. And the city just said, sorry, not going to do that. I think there's 2,200 units of affordable housing in Regent Park, or there were before redevelopment began. And once it's finished, there'll be 1,500. So it's a reduction of about a third in the amount of affordable housing. In a place like Toronto, you know, where we have a waiting list for affordable housing of 70,000 families, this, in my opinion, is just the wrong thing to do.
Root believes their approach of creating a mixed-income community will make Regent Park a desirable place for anyone to live.
The great thing about what's happening with the revitalization is, in addition to replacing 2,083 social housing units, which were built in the 1940s, so very old, very outdated, energy efficiency, well, non-existent, we are also adding about 700 what we call affordable rental. And so those will be 700 net additional affordable rental units in the east downtown that didn't exist before that are being created in conjunction with this project. So we're replacing old stock and we're building additional new.
And Aisha can tell how things will turn out in Regent because of what's already happened in the surrounding area.
It is extremely valuable land that is, I think the other people would see it as being wasted, and it's extremely, you know, the market value of that land is just through the roof. From what I've looked at the plan, it seems to me like condominiums and the private housing is going to be mostly on the edges and the social housing is going to be in the middle. So to me, that's kind of like Cabbage Town and Regent Park at the moment. The only difference is you're condensing the social housing from whereas it used to cover a wider range of space, now it's just more condensed.
Clark sees this revitalization making Regent Park a safe and friendly neighborhood in Toronto.
The whole idea is to make it like any other neighborhood where you can't tell who has money and who doesn't have money. And the neighborhood I grew up in, you didn't know who owned and who rented and all the rest. So it's really, the idea is to make it like any other neighborhood and take the stigma away from living in what a lot of people consider the ghetto.
This stigma, mentioned by Clark, relates to the high levels of poverty and crime associated with Regent Park. However, Sewell mentions that this was due to poor planning on the city's part during the original development.
The crime is caused almost entirely by the way it's designed. If you designed it intelligently, then, sorry, you're always going to have crime. There's crime in Rosedale. There's crime in Forest Hill. But the point is that it's much more managed if you've designed things in appropriate ways. I mean, you know, if you go just north of Girard Street, just north of Regent Park, you're into 19th century houses. There's not a great deal of street crime in that area, and it's simply because of the way you design things. So I think the redesign of Regent is going to help to reduce crime.
The dramatic change taking place around her makes Aisha realize that many people are going to miss the old Regent Park and its strong social dynamic.
When they were breaking down the building in the first phase, I wasn't the only one. I know a lot of people, like of my friends and staff and acquaintances, everybody felt that little bit of sadness knowing like, oh, that was the park that I used to play, you know, that was the, you know, the road I used to go down when I'd go to school and whatnot. And just to see all that being broken down, it just kind of, I don't know, people don't like change, but it just saddens you a bit on the inside. But I mean, you know it has to happen, and it will eventually, but it's just a bit saddening.
In Regent Park, Toronto, I'm Adam Bema.
That was the Rabble Podcast Network's Street Cred Podcast. To hear more docs and interviews, go to rabble.ca/podcasts and click on the link to Street Cred.
In 2008, the Toronto Star's Olivia Ward wrote an article on the 10 worst countries in which a woman can live. Since then, Canada has continued its military effort in Afghanistan, but we hear less and less about the struggles of women living there. The Rabble Podcast Network's Sachin Seth caught up with Olivia Ward to see what has changed for women since she wrote that first article. Here's their conversation.
Hey, Olivia. Thanks for joining us. Earlier this year, you wrote an article ranking the worst 10 countries in which a woman can live. On that list, you had Iraq, a country that before the American invasion had some very liberal women's rights as compared to the rest of the Arab world. Now, after the American invasion, things like women's literacy rates have dropped severely. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think there were a number of reasons. One of them was that right after the invasion, of course, the whole country was in a shambles. And people were confined to their homes, so the educational system for everyone virtually ground to a halt. Secondly, once that sort of shook down a little bit and people were able to move around a bit, they realized that a lot of schoolhouses had been either destroyed or were just not in a workable state because they had no electricity, no water, no facilities of any kind. So those were the more immediate conditions, but the longer term was that once students were able to go back into the classroom, they found that women and young girls especially were being targeted, so that any girl who was on her way to school or even in the classroom or coming home from school could be targeted for kidnapping, which often included rape, which would leave the girl not only devastated, but in many cases unmarriageable in the future.
Okay, but what was the situation before? I mean, why are these girls being targeted more now than they were before the U.S. invasion?
It was really, again, it was a slightly complex picture. Part of it was because Iraq had been under such tight control under Saddam's rule beforehand that people, whether they were criminally inclined or ordinary citizens, were just living under the thumb of Saddam's forces. So when that was lifted, there were a lot of criminals who were let loose in the society. And in fact, I was there when Saddam himself released huge numbers of criminals from jails on the kind of understanding that if there were an invasion, they'd be on his side. So there were a lot of these people rattling around the country. They were well-armed because there are a lot of guns in Iraq, and you only need one to commit a crime, especially if it's kidnapping a young girl. So they were there. They were criminals. They already had a history of violence, and they were ready to do it again. There were also sectarian gangs who did this because they ideologically opposed women's education. And then there were just the opportunists who knew that there was kidnapping going on, and they themselves may never have done anything like this before, but they figured they were desperate and they had to get some money somehow.
Well, you more than most people know that it's hard to describe some of the things that happen to women around the world, especially in places like the Democratic Republic of Congo, Sudan. In your opinion, what do you think can be done about these things? Is it up to the people or is it up to the governments?
Well, it's definitely not up to the people, simply because ordinary people, which generally means women, because women are often the only ones who are left after a terrible massacre or in a certain area where men have fled to join militias or they've fled from other militias. So women are often completely on their own and unprotected. And that also, by the way, is the case in refugee camps, where you would think people are protected, but indeed they're not. So, yes, I think that there's no way that you can say that the people themselves can protect themselves. It has to be some sort of government or international force. And in Congo, because the situation is very complex, there is an official government which is considered to be sort of capable, and the government has actually come out against sexual violence. However, it doesn't really enforce that, and for a woman to actually get to the court if she has been raped, if she survives the ordeal, it is very, very difficult for her to see any kind of justice, because the way the law is enforced is certainly not the kind of standards you'd see in the West.
But really, the women who do experience acts of sexual violence, they don't have the authority to report it and be taken seriously. So in the end, it is up to some sort of international body, because a lot of the local governments sometimes don't act, no matter what, really.
That's right. And it very much depends on where you are. The Congo is a good case in point, because there's nothing wrong in Congo with a woman reporting that she's being raped. But the problem is the way in which the law is enforced, and the fact that in the courts it's not really taken seriously. Plus, there is a lot of corruption with relatives of an accused man getting into the act, and a very low possibility that the man will be convicted, plus the fact that the woman could well be intimidated, by advocates of the guy who's been arrested. So that makes it difficult. When you come to a place like, say Iran, for instance, there are horrific stories about women who've been raped, and Pakistan is the same, through no fault of their own. And yet, when they actually try and bring the case to court, they are the ones who end up behind bars.
So you said that it could be up to international courts to aid women in these kind of situations. I was reading an article you recently wrote about how the UN Security Council declared sexual violence a war crime. Do you think anything will come or has come from this declaration?
I think actually things have come of it. And the international court, I'm glad to say that under the present very active prosecutor of the ICC at The Hague, this is taken extremely seriously. And in cases like the one that's now going forward of Thomas Lubanga, who is an extremely powerful warlord, sexual violence is one of the charges. And more sexual violence is added to the charge sheet of people who are sent to the international court.
You've been writing for quite a while now, and you've seen a lot of things, and you've heard a lot of things. When you hear about a new event, a new bizarre event, does it still shock you, or are you kind of immune to that now?
Well, I have to admit that I have not been shocked for quite a long time, but when I was first asked to write about Congo, and I have not been to Congo, but I was sort of pressed into the service to write about it, and the more I read about it, and then... when I began to interview Congolese women who had actually come to Toronto, I truly was shocked, because what they've experienced in the way of sexual violence is not just what you'd call ordinary rape, if there is such a thing. I mean, their bodies and in many cases their minds, their emotions have been completely destroyed, and many of them die because they're so badly hurt. But others who somehow manage to get to hospital have to undergo, multiple surgeries, if such a thing is available, and most of them aren't even able to do that. There just isn't the access. And so they will spend the rest of what are usually very short lives in agony, and never for one minute forgetting what happened to them.
Well, medical treatment for women who experience sexual violence in the Congo isn't really available, right?
Very, very little. There is one extremely good hospital in Goma, mm-hmm. Which is headed by a really wonderful male surgeon, and he has done everything that he can, but he would have to be operating at this point like 24 hours a day mm-hmm. if he was going to really improve things in terms of percentages. I mean, he does absolutely everything he can, and he has a small dedicated staff who work with him, but there just are not, countrywide or even province-wide, which is really more to the point in eastern Congo where the conflict is, there just are not the resources.
That was Sachin Seth speaking with journalist Olivia Ward.
That's the end of this episode of Rabble Radio. Don't forget that Rabble.ca runs using the money that you give us. If you think independent media is important, and you'd be sad to see it go, donating is the best way for you to ensure that we'll be able to continue operating and improving. Thanks for listening to this episode of Rabble Radio. I'm Wayne McPhail.
Talk to you next time. I'm Megan Perry.
That was a clip from a January 2010 episode of Rabble Radio. To listen to the full original program, visit the link in the show notes of this episode. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. This week's In Case You Missed It is presented by Rabble's Hannah Bulwell.
Starting this week in national politics, the U.S. planned to slap even more tariffs on Canadian goods, and this would cause complications for the automotive industry. The cross-border integration necessary to manufacture, assemble, and transport car parts across the United States, Mexico, and Canada means the auto sector would suffer the most under these new tariffs. Car parts from Canada and Canadian assembled cars would face tariffs when sold across the border, but Canadian car parts that are sent to the U.S. for American assembled cars would not. This is part of the White House's plan to disrupt the North American assembly line and bring manufacturing jobs back to the United States. So far, it has led to the loss of work for 2,200 Canadians. Many furloughed workers have been receiving 70% of their wages, but thousands of workers and members of the communities have lost their livelihoods. Even before Trump's tariff campaign, Canada's assembly for the big three American car companies, which are Ford, General Motors, and Stellantis/Chrysler, were already declining over the past decade. From 2026 to 2025, Canada went from assembling 2.3 million vehicles to only 1.2 million. Over 75% of vehicles assembled in Canada are now from Toyota and Honda. In 2025, the Japanese manufacturers employed more than 60% of Canada's assembly plant workers and built more cars in Canada than the big three combined. Finally, in political news, NDP candidate in the Beaches East York by-election, Shannon Devine, feels the tides are changing in the NDP's favor. Prime Minister Mark Carney won the federal election on the grounds that he was the best candidate to stand up to Donald Trump. During his tenure so far, he has caved in favor of dropping the digital services tax, increased our use of fossil fuels, and cut thousands of public jobs. With Prime Minister Mark Carney and the Liberal Party's failure to follow through on initial promises, former Liberal voters have been drawn to the NDP's campaign. With a focus on the housing crisis and grocery prices, the NDP has been able to offer practical solutions, such as publicly funded grocery stores. Over 300 people attended Devine's campaign launch. Devine said, quote, "That was the biggest NDP event I have ever seen in Beaches, East York. And I've been involved here for 11 years. End quote. As always, you can read the full versions of all of these stories talked about today on Rabble.ca.
And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks so much for listening. To help support our show further, consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. You can also choose to subscribe to us over on Patreon for special bonus content of Rabble Radio. If you're already subscribed, consider making a donation to Rabble.ca at Rabble.ca/donate. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nuremberg for supplying the music to this episode. I'm Nick Seabrook, and we'll talk to you next time.